Case 22-5370, USA versus Montrez Duncan. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Salinas, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Melissa Salinas from the University of Michigan Law School, and I'm here supervising student attorney Will Jankowski. Thank you for allowing him to present.
Thank you for bringing him. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you doing it. Mr. Jankowski, it's my understanding you're saving 4 minutes for rebuttal. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Judge Thapar.
Okay, you may proceed.
Good afternoon. Will Jankowski for Appellant Montrez Duncan. May it please the court, I know the court is familiar with the facts of this case, but I'd like to briefly emphasize an important set of facts underlying each of our arguments here today. This case stems from a single robbery that occurred on a single night over roughly a 24-hour period. At the first sentencing, Mr. Duncan and his co-defendant, Mr. Fitzgerald, were sentenced to the exact same 300-month sentence on the exact same counts. Years later, after vacating the 924C counts, the same court sentenced Mr. Fitzgerald to 180 months concurrent, less time served. But the court sentenced Mr. Duncan to consecutive Hobbs Act sentences for a total of 300 months. And that brings us to our primary argument today. At Mr. Duncan's resentencing, the court failed to explain this new sentence, resulting in two related errors, a failure to explain imposing consecutive sentences and a failure to rebut a presumption of sentencing vindictiveness. This sentence was procedurally unreasonable because the court abused its discretion by imposing consecutive sentences without adequately explaining those sentences in violation of the statutory command in 3584 and this court's published precedent in Cochran. The plain meaning of 3584 makes mandatory that any imposition of consecutive sentences.
Do you agree that the presumption in this a case like this one would be that they would be consecutive sentences?
No, Your Honor, not according to the text of 3584, according to Cochran, which both mandate that the court's consideration of the sentencing factors be either explicitly relied on or implicitly referred to with respect to the court's specific decision to impose consecutive sentences.
But on resentencing, the judge, obviously he specifically ordered rebriefing or new briefing on the consecutive issue.
Correct.
And specifically directed, if I remember the transcript correctly, that it cover the 3553A factors in that new briefing. So he was clearly thinking about all of that. Why isn't that enough to kind of get over that hurdle?
Because, Your Honor, Cochran states that it's not enough. Merely imposing, even after a fulsome discussion of the 3553A factors, merely stating that a sentence is to run consecutively does not meet the judge's, the court in that kind of a scenario has not met its obligation to explain its specific decision to impose consecutive sentences.
But what else does he have to say? I mean, it seems to me that some of our cases at least have suggested that, look, if you've talked about the 3553A factors, he clearly thinks that Duncan is culpable, in fact, perhaps more culpable than Fitzgerald, that he's in a different position. He goes through all of that. That clearly influences his decision to make the sentences consecutive, don't you think? I mean, I don't know how else you could read that.
So that might be true, Your Honor, but unfortunately that kind of logic isn't on the record before us today, and that strikes at the heart of the issue here in the resentencing. No.
Can I follow up on that? Because 3584B says, in making this determination, you specifically shall consider the 3553A factors. Chief Judge Crenshaw asked for briefing, as Judge Nalbandian said, and then he gets the briefing and goes through the 3553A factors. Why isn't that sufficient?
It's not sufficient because the trial counsel at resentencing specifically asked for the 180-month concurrent sentence, and the Judge Crenshaw never in this case specifically addressed and responded to that argument. The discussion of the 3553...
That's a different argument in kind, right? Are you saying just by asking for 180 months, you trigger that?
In this case, we would argue that the court would have been obligated to respond to and again under 3584B specifically make the finding that the 3553A factors justified imposing consecutive sentences in this case. And the problem is that specific finding doesn't appear on the record at this resentencing. And Judge Nalbandian, just to pick up on a point you mentioned before about the culpability, the relative culpability of the two defendants in this case, this gets a little bit into our second argument today, but the problem with that kind of inference at resentencing is that that was not clear from the record at initial sentencing that the court in this case thought that these defendants had differing levels of culpability. And the difference between the sentence imposed, which at first sentencing was exactly the same for each of these defendants on exactly the same kinds of counts, suggests maybe that actually the court made this finding specifically a couple of times, that actually the similarity between these two defendants was too significant to ignore.
Why would he be vindictive against one and not the other?
We simply don't know, Judge White, and that's the problem with what happened at this resentencing. The trial counsel at resentencing for Mr. Duncan specifically stated and asked, put before the judge, that Mr. Duncan should not be in a worse situation today because he successfully vacated one of the counts under which he was convicted.
But he wasn't.
I'm sorry?
He wasn't in a worse situation. The judge basically said, look, I've looked at everything. The judge asked for briefs. He read everything, went over his notes, and basically said, this is, even without the 924, this is really serious conduct, and I'm sentencing the same conduct, and I think the same sentence is appropriate under all the factors.
The difference here is that the court did not give that kind of an assessment to reducing co-defendant Fitzgerald's sentence in this case. And so again, this will get us to our actual vindictiveness argument.
Did Fitzgerald have a plea agreement?
That's true, Your Honor, but he...
I mean, and under the terms of the plea agreement, there was supposed to be a sentencing recommendation, wasn't there?
That's my recollection from the record, yes.
So the government and Fitzgerald jointly recommend 180 months or whatever it is, so the judge, you know, goes along with it. Your client doesn't have that kind of agreement, so I don't know why they aren't completely different. I mean, they're not similarly situated. That plea agreement alone, I think, would account for the difference, right?
The problem is this was also true at the first sentencing, and this was also true when the district court imposed the same exact sentence on each of these defendants at initial sentencing. There were no changed facts. A plea agreement is not binding. You know, the district court does not need to accept the plea agreement.
Was there a different recommendation at the first at an initial sentence for Fitzgerald?
That I'm unsure, Your Honor. He pled guilty.
Wouldn't that be the key question? Because it's not clear to me that the judge changed his mind with respect to Fitzgerald at all, except to conform with whatever the government and Fitzgerald agreed to. So I don't know why that would be problematic, given that he's got the plea agreement.
It's problematic with respect to the judge's assessment of the interdependence of the 924C count and how it relates to the other counts that each of these defendants was convicted of. When the government came back with its plea agreement for the second sentencing, the sentence was reduced by 120 months, exactly the same length as the sentence for the mandatory consecutive 924C count, and the judge accepted that. Apparently, thought whether you know. Our core argument is that it's unclear from the record of resentencing, but this leads to the inference that perhaps the judge, when he was sentencing initially, absolutely did consider that the 924C count was independent of the sentences that were to be imposed on the Hobbs Act counts, and it's not clear why that wouldn't also have been true in Mr. Duncan's case, especially when the judge at initial sentencing affirmatively sought to put on the record exactly how similar these two defendants were. Whether it was a plea recommendation, a plea deal or not, the judge was obligated to consider the 3553A factors with respect to Mr. Fitzgerald's sentence, did so, and found, specifically with respect to Mr. Duncan, that these two defendants were similar to each other.
Do you happen to know whether Mr. Fitzgerald had a similar record in prison?
I don't, Your Honor, but again, on that point, I'll stress that all of the infractions that were the reckless homicide, I think, was on the record, that occurred before trial and that occurred before sentencing and was litigated extensively at trial and was litigated extensively prior to the first sentencing. This was all information that was before the district court, before he made his initial sentence decision. None of that information changed. There were minor infractions, a cell phone infraction, and I think two other failure to obey, something along those lines. No other objective changes in the information before the district court would support the kind of essential increase, what we're arguing today, an increase in Mr. Duncan's sentence by 120 months as compared to his co-defendant.
I mean, the 3553A factors make clear that's not necessarily a defendant v. defendant comparison, but a nationwide one. And of course, the court can consider it, but it's not required to. And they take individual circumstances into account. And the district court was pretty exhaustive with its 3553A factors. So isn't that what we review? And I didn't even see an objection, maybe I missed it, to sentencing disparities under the relevant 3553A factor.
No, Your Honor, that occurred at the... I'm actually unclear as to whether the judge brought it up sua sponte, but that discussion happened at the first sentencing. The judge affirmatively put on the record the similarity.
This is a plenary, right? This is a new sentencing in full.
That's correct, Your Honor. But the judge was permitted and indeed given the importance of that factor to initial sentencing, should have considered exactly this factor. The judge himself deemed this factor to be a...
But you didn't object.
At second sentencing, so counsel objected on vindictiveness grounds, which was to say...
That's different, right? We agree that's different.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. Even under sort of a substantive reasonableness disparity argument, which would make up our third argument, separate from the vindictiveness point, this should be assessed for an abuse of discretion anyway.
And do you agree that even though it wasn't specifically stated on the record in the first sentencing that if you just look at the numbers, the scoring numbers, Mr. Duncan had received that two-level increase for the leadership.
Yeah. So I see I'm at time.
The first time around, he in fact had received it.
So I see I'm at time. May I respond? The government can offer its best reading as to what the sentencing record shows. The problem here is that the sentencing at resentencing, and to some extent with this organizer enhancement at initial sentencing, is flawed because the judge did not adequately explain or put on the record its findings with respect to these specific sentencing issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. Mahogany Reed for the United States. I'll start by responding to your question, Judge White, about whether the district court added the organizer enhancement at Mr. Duncan's original sentencing.
Can you keep your voice up?
Yes, Your Honor. It's our understanding, the government's belief, that the district court did apply the organizer enhancement at Mr. Duncan's original sentencing, and you can gather that by looking at the district court's calculation of Mr. Duncan's total offense level. We expressed our belief at Mr. Duncan's original sentencing that the court had applied that enhancement. Page 80 of the original sentencing transcript, we said, because the court has assessed the organizer enhancement, we think it was appropriate to do so here in arguing for our substantive sentence. And so we do think that the court certainly did not err in reapplying it at Mr. Duncan's resentencing, but even if there was error, as we outline in our brief, any error did not affect Mr. Duncan's substantial rights because it did not affect his guidelines range. I'll pick up with Mr. Duncan's procedural challenge to the district court's explanation of its reasons for imposing consecutive sentences. We believe that because Mr. Duncan did not specifically object to the district court's allegedly inadequate explanation in response to the court's Bostic question, this court should review for plain error. And we think the clearest indication that the objection was not specific enough to apprise the court that Mr. Duncan was objecting to the allegedly inadequate explanation is that Mr. Duncan relies on that very same response to the court's Bostic question to preserve his vindictiveness challenge. And we just don't see how Mr. Duncan can rely on that one statement to both preserve a procedural challenge to the district court's allegedly inadequate explanation and also a constitutional challenge to the substance of the court's sentence.
Why not? I mean, it's clear that the consecutive sentence issue is going to be a big issue at this sentencing, and it's clear that he's not going along with it. And he, I mean, I, I don't know. I mean, maybe you're right, but I don't know that. I mean, what else was he supposed to say? Everybody's got an argument in this case about, you know, that people didn't say things specifically enough. But I guess maybe I'm thinking everybody was kind of close enough.
Yeah, well, Your Honor, for purposes of lodging a procedural challenge to a district court's allegedly inadequate explanation, close enough is just not close enough under this court's case law, which require that a defendant specifically let the court know that it's...
Case law is a little bit muddled on that, don't you think? Is it the Blackie case is one, and then we've got Bonner says a few things? I mean, it seems like there's some... questions about whether if a defendant raises something beforehand, even an inadequate explanation argument, whether they've got to specifically reiterate it with the... I understand it makes sense, but I'm not sure our case law is exactly crystal clear on that.
I think reading the Bostick decision, which does require that courts, that defendants make generally clear not only the nature of their objection, but also the grounds in conjunction with cases we cite in our brief, like Davis and Majors and Murphy, this court has specifically emphasized and reemphasized, based on my reading of the case law, that an inadequate explanation objection has to be very specific to that objection. So
I think you're right on the case law, but what about our Cochran decision, which says that you have to put something on the record? Why wouldn't that be, let's assume it's plain error, why wouldn't that at least be plain?
If I'm understanding your question correctly, the district court's we think that the district court's explanation of its reasons for the substantive sentence built in its explanation for the consecutive sentences.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Cochran says pretty specifically that, I mean, it seems to me Cochran says that's not good enough, doesn't it?
Well, I do want to do one thing, which is to distinguish Cochran on the facts, because Cochran was a revocation proceeding. And so it's different in kind than what we have here, because at a revocation proceeding, not only was the court in Cochran imposing a substantive sentence for the underlying offense that was the violation of supervised release, but it was also selecting a revocation sentence, and then after that, deciding how to structure the substantive sentence and the revocation sentence to run with each other. And so the court explained that because even if the sort of bare bones and the whole of the district court's explanation for selecting the substantive sentence is very brief, included in the Cochran decision itself, even if that's sufficient to explain why the court selected the substantive sentence under 3584B, the court did not specifically explain why it imposed the structured the revocation and substantive sentences to run consecutive to one another. I think that's distinct from this case, where the court necessarily had to structure the sentences to run consecutive to one another because it selected a total punishment that exceeded the statutory maxes on one of the Hobbs Act counts. And so the court had no choice but to run the sentences consecutive to one another. And, you know, I think, Judge Nalbandian, I think your questions and your point about the court having gone through the record, having asked questions of the parties about how to structure the sentences at the October 14, 2021 resentencing hearing, directing the probation office to outline the court's guidelines and statutory authority to run the sentences consecutive or concurrent with one another, and ordering the parties to specifically brief the issue, just kind of lets us know that the court was very well, this wasn't a decision the court made in a vacuum without apprising the parties.
Can I ask you about another argument that Mr. Jankowski made, which I found interesting at least, and maybe potentially problematic for the government? It seems that at the original resentencing, sentencing disparity between defendants was important to the judge. Doesn't he have an obligation at this point to explain to us why it no longer has that level of import?
It certainly may have been preferable for the court to explain that, but we think under the circumstances, the court was under no obligation to do so for a couple of reasons. One, Mr. Duncan's counsel, while he raised the issue of co-defendant disparities at Mr. Duncan's initial sentencing, did not raise the issue at Mr. Duncan's resentencing, and so the court was certainly not under any obligation to sua sponte raise what I think
Mr.
Duncan
I thought the court brought it up, did he not?
At Mr. Duncan's original sentencing, he heard arguments statement from Mr. Duncan's counsel about the issue of co-defendant disparity. I think that was the very last point that Mr. Duncan's counsel made, was that the government's position as to Mr. Fitzgerald was that he should receive 300 months under the plea agreement. The government's position as to Mr. Duncan was that he should receive 600 months, and that is a disparity that the court shouldn't countenance, and the court agreed ultimately.
You're talking about at the original.
At the original, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but at the resentencing, you're saying that that nobody raised, not even the judge, raised the disparity issue?
Not in that sense, right? No, not even the judge. Counsel for Mr. Duncan, I'm sorry, did not raise the disparity issue at the resentencing hearing, and we agree that the court on its own did not do a similar comparison of Mr. Duncan's and Mr. Fitzgerald's criminal histories and backgrounds that it did at Mr. Duncan's original sentencing. We do think the district court...
What about the plea agreement? Was there a sentencing recommendation with Fitzgerald, and was it different? I assume it was different for his resentencing as opposed to the first time around?
That's right, Your Honor. At Mr. Fitzgerald, in the first round of sentencing before vacature of the 924C conviction as to Mr. Fitzgerald, the government and counsel for Mr. Fitzgerald agreed to a 300-month sentence, which was a within-guideline sentence. The district court accepted that plea agreement. At Mr. Fitzgerald's, after the district court vacated Mr. Fitzgerald's 924C conviction, the court did not hold a resentencing hearing. Rather, the court requested a sentencing recommendation from the parties. The government and counsel for Mr. Fitzgerald submitted a sentencing recommendation of 180 months minus the 76 months Mr. Fitzgerald had served in state custody on the related drug conviction. And the district court, without ordering a new PSR, without conducting a resentencing, accepted to the party's sentencing recommendation as to Mr. Fitzgerald. So we're dealing with a very different, and I think your questions about the nature of the plea kind of go to the fact that we're dealing with a very different procedural posture when it comes to Mr. Duncan, where the court, well within its discretion, ordered a totally new resentencing hearing, reweighed the 3553A factors, and just the bar to your question, the court was not bound to its previous weighing of the 3553A factors. This court, in cases like Augustin and Flack, has emphasized that at a resentencing, a district court is essentially conducting a sentencing anew and is not can reweigh the 3553A factors to construct a sentence that it thinks is appropriate under the circumstances. And that's what the court did here. It believed, as it explained at the end of Mr. Duncan's sentencing hearing, that because it was sentencing the same behavior, the court should impose the same sentence. And that leads me to...
Do you think in the abstract, if the judge had thought to himself, this is a 300-month case, okay, fine, I had to get rid of this count under Davis, but I still think it's a 300-month case, so I'm going to get there a different way. Would that be allowed, if he said that on the record, would that be permitted? I mean, can he go in with a conclusion like that?
We think certainly his justification would have to be rooted in the 3553A factors. That's a statutory mandate that the court is bound by. But we do think that if the court believes it's sentencing the same behavior, goes through why that same behavior is in the way that this court did is egregious, is the worst. Theft and robbery and firearm-related offense the court had sentenced. If the court goes through all of that and says, and because I'm sentencing the same egregious, terrible behavior, sentencing the same defendant with extensive violent criminal history background, that the same sentence is warranted, we think that is totally appropriate. But again, it does have to be rooted in the 3553A factors, and the court's sentence here was. And I do just briefly want to touch on Mr. Duncan's vindictiveness challenge. We think, again, that challenge is not preserved. We don't think the substance of Mr. Duncan's objections below made out the substance of a vindictiveness challenge. If anything, we think that Mr. Duncan disclaimed any belief that the district court was acting out of vengeance or retribution when in his motion to alter or amend the judgment.
How do you deal with our Murphy case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How do you deal with Murphy?
Well, I think Murphy is inapposite here because we do think that, well, one, it's an unpublished decision that this court certainly isn't bound by, but two, we think that the Hobbs Act counts and the 924C counts are interdependent under Clements and under Foster. It's very clear under Foster that the district court did account for the mandatory 120-month sentence in constructing the sentence it would impose on the Hobbs Act counts. And it's clear that when the district court vacated the 924C conviction, that ultimately affected Mr. Duncan's guidelines. So under any sort of articulation of interdependence and independence, we think that the counts are interdependent here. And so it's very clear that under this court's general metric of calculating whether a new sentence is higher or lower than an original sentence, this sentence is the same. But whether you disagree with that, we also think that the circumstances of this case are not ones that would give rise to the presumption of vindictiveness. The district court vacated its own judgment on Mr. Duncan's unopposed 2255 motion because intervening Supreme Court precedent rendered his 924C count conviction. These are not the circumstances in which a district court would have motivation to engage in self-vindication, which is essentially has become the sine qua non of a vindictiveness challenge under cases like McCullough and Goodwin, really since Pierce. And so we don't think the vindictiveness presumption arose in this case.
How does that work with Murphy? How does the framework? I mean, are you saying that if I have the same judge, he reverses himself, vacates his own sentence, imposes a new one, it's the same sentence in total as the previous sentence? Does that just take the presumption off the books then, regardless of whether there were counts that were interdependent or whatever, or would Murphy on its own terms still have something to do with that? Murphy, I take it, was a reversal on appeal and then a remand, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So it didn't have the question of the judge himself doing this.
That's right, Your Honor. But we think the same framework would apply because we think there's essentially no difference for purposes of calculating whether a sentence is higher or lower or the same, whether the count is vacated on appeal or the count is vacated by the same district court. Where that comes in is just assessing whether the circumstances generally are such that we would think the presumption of vindictiveness might arise.
So you think, in theory, if it's the same judge, and he imposes the same sentence, or the judge reverses himself, imposes the same overall sentence, could there in theory still be a presumption of vindictiveness?
Yes, Your Honor, I see my time is up. If I can just respond to the question.
How?
We think that in theory, so if it's the same judge who reverses and imposes the same sentence. No. We don't think the presumption would arise if the court imposes the same sentence. The court would have to impose a higher sentence for the possibility of the presumption to arise. And we think that even in that case, the presumption wouldn't necessarily arise. We'd have to look at other circumstances to assess whether they're such that the presumption is applicable. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Jankowski, before you start, I'm going to ask two questions. One is, why isn't there a presumption against vindictiveness when the district court is doing it? Usually when we think about vindictiveness, it's the district court that's upset that they got reversed. Here, the district court on its own handled the vacating of the conviction. The second is, why isn't it sufficient that your counsel below argued that they should be concurrent and that they should impose 180 months, and the district court rejected that and specifically said your client's conduct is much more culpable. He's the leader. He's telling him to shoot after he's down. He's instructing him that he's not dead and he should shoot him more, etc. But you get the point that why don't those two factors, A, deal with vindictiveness and deal with the consecutive nature, because you made the argument he clearly rejects it when he imposes a 300-month sentence, and 3584 only requires discussing the 3553A factors, which he does.
So yes, Your Honor, just on that point very briefly, Cochran is what explains how the court is supposed to address the 3553A factors with respect.
But Cochran's not a plain error case, so how do you deal with that?
No, so I'll note firstly that we also rely on Michael Johnson, which I think also governs squarely here with respect to assessing for plain error. But when we ask whether the objection was specific, it... Reading Bostick is a case in which there was no pre-hearing motion made on the specific issue that was raised. There was no argument made on the specific issue that was raised during the sentencing hearing, the party objecting was not able to preserve because, if I'm getting the history of this correct, because the court did not specifically ask for an objection, a broad objection.
Judge Crenshaw does.
So that's correct, Your Honor. And the difference in this case is that the pre-sentencing hearings, the briefings on the issue, the argument at sentencing, made clear that this was an issue that the court was going to have to address.
Sure, but then he goes through the 3553A factors. He says, you're an extremely bad guy, basically, I'm summarizing, and I need to put you in jail for 300 months. That pretty clearly addresses that, and if you wanted more of an explanation, as your friend on the other side said, a clear procedural objection to the explanation. Didn't you have an obligation under our case law post-Bostick to raise it when Judge Crenshaw asked? You could say, instead of us having to remand so we can give the explanation, that's the whole point of Bostick. Say, I didn't get a clear explanation. Can you please explain why you're imposing consecutive sentences? It seems to me when you read the whole of the transcript, it's pretty obvious, but I'm just wondering.
That's correct, Your Honor. The trial counsel's specific response to the Bostick question here, the exact language of which is something like, it effectively is the same sentence as before, just fashioned a different way. And the difference in the fashioning of these two sentences, page ID.
Yeah, that's not specific enough, right, to advise the district court. I mean, district courts are busy, and they're going through these, you know, sometimes five sentencings a day. He's asked for memos on it. He's explained it. I mean, under Bostick, you have to give a specific objection.
I think you've, sir, I just want to add, it's the same question. I don't think there's any question that you preserved your objection to a consecutive sentence. I mean, that's clear. It's a different question whether you preserved your objection to the adequacy of the explanation.
I think in this case, that's what the Bostick question is aimed at eliciting from the judge. That's why Bostick exists. Bostick exists to give the parties an opportunity to raise an issue and for the court to provide a more fulsome explanation.
But why isn't that your downfall? That's my question.
Because here in this case,
the
only difference between how the sentence was initially fashioned and how the sentence was fashioned at resentencing was the consecutive nature of the sentences. Again, if the judge had run the sentences concurrently as he had at first sentence, he would have been limited to the statutory maximum of 20 years. So there's just no way, there's no other kind of change to the sentence that counsel could have been objecting at in this particular instance. With that,
one question.
Sure.
What do you contend the guideline range was?
The guideline range should have been 360 months to 480.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that guideline range took into account the fact that there were two offenses.
That's correct, Your Honor. The offenses themselves were grouped for the purposes of sentencing. The base offense level was 20 and is 20 for each of the Hobbs Act violations, but they were grouped. It's based on the offense level in the criminal history is what gets us to
that
range.
What?
Sorry?
I didn't understand what you just said. It's based on...
The sentencing table, the offense level factored in things like the firearm enhancement, the organizer enhancement, et cetera, and then the criminal history. That gives us the range of 360 to life, which in this case is, because the court could only sentence to the statutory maximum, would have been limited to the 480 top months. But the offenses were grouped for the purposes of sentencing because this was a single course of conduct, a completed conspiracy that resulted in the substantive crime that was charged.
Yeah, but you do concede that the structure of the guidelines and all the sentencing allows for a sentence in excess of the maximum and indeed contemplates it. And when that happens, I meant the statutory maximum, and when that happens, it's effectuated by running the sentences consecutively.
So, Your Honor, we can guess at, I think 5G1.2, the sentencing guideline, is what outlines that kind of a course of action for a court to take. The problem is the court did not explain that reasoning here.
But once the court concluded that 300 months was still the proper sentence under 3553A, it was automatic that it would be consecutive.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think Cochran teaches that it is not automatic with respect to the specific decision to run consecutively. Even the language from Cochran is that you must indicate on the record the court's rationale, either expressly or by reference to a discussion of relevant considerations elsewhere. And the court did not do that after the Bostic question. That's the problem here, and that's the fundamental issue with what happened at resentencing in this case.
But it also says, right, that you don't have to give a specific reason for a consecutive sentence.
No, Your Honor, incorporating by reference certain discussion elsewhere, but again, that did not happen on the record.
So if the court had said everything it said, including that he's looked at everything and he still thinks it's 300, and had simply said, and under the guidelines, having concluded that part of the sentence will run consecutively.
That may suffice, Your Honor. Of course, it's up to this court to decide on appeal. I would point to the similarity between the two defendants as being an important factor and a pertinent factor that the court considered, rejected the government's argument for a 600-month sentence for Mr. Duncan because of, in large part, that similarity between the two defendants, and did not adequately consider at resentencing. That provides further evidence for the fact that this presumption of concurrence that we established under 3584 A and B and under Cochran was particularly strong in this specific case. And the
but
judge,
you agree the district court did say that he was, that your client was worse than the others and more culpable and a leader.
I agree that some of those points are on the record.
So while, I'm sorry to interrupt you. And while 600 months may be a lot more, when it's 300 versus 180, it makes more sense. In other words, double the amount. And 600, that seems a lot. But now he's varying down from the guidelines and giving him 300. I mean, you're asking for a huge variance. It's a 50% variance that you're ultimately asking for.
Well, if the judge had failed to adequately explain why these sentences should be run consecutively, the sentence would have been limited to 20 years to begin with anyway. There's no discretion to vary above that without adequately explaining the consecutive.
But the stacking is, the guidelines counsel stacking when you've got this situation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, we do not have that kind of logic on the record before us today. That's the fundamental issue with this resentencing.
Okay. Any more? Thank you very much. Ms. Salinas, I want to thank you for bringing Mr. Jankowski. If you keep bringing students like him, we'll be happy to have you. His argument was excellent. We appreciate it. The arguments will be submitted, and thank you to both sides for your thoughtful arguments.